We good to go? Okay, my name's Catherine Lewis. I'm a PhD student at Cardiff University, and I'm going to talk about the phase one development of a guided self-help programme for mild to moderate post-traumatic stress disorder. So this is a treatment intervention aimed at individuals with chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, so a bit different to Joanne's intervention. So I'd first like to confirm that I don't have any conflicts of interest. So I'm going to begin by presenting the rationale behind carrying out this work. I'll then go on to discuss our methods, our progress to date, and our future directions. So first, to present the research rationale. When it comes to treating post-traumatic stress disorder, it seems that psychological therapies can be effective. Many different forms of psychological therapy have been applied to the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder over the years, but it is those that focus on the traumatic event itself and issues surrounding it which seem to be the most effective. These trauma-focused psychological therapies, including trauma-focused cognitive behavioural therapy and eye movement desensitisation and reprocessing, have been identified as being particularly helpful, and these are currently the treatments of choice for post-traumatic stress disorder in the United Kingdom, and I believe also elsewhere. So evidence for pharmacological interventions, such as the use of antidepressants and antipsychotics, is far less compelling. The problem with treating post-traumatic stress disorder is that there are a limited number of qualified therapists able to deliver these interventions. As a result, waiting times in excess of a year are common in the United Kingdom, and in Cardiff, where I work, the waiting lists are currently over 6 months long to get psychological therapy. So new methods of delivering effective intervention are clearly needed, and guided self-help is a potential alternative method which hasn't been adequately explored to date. So what exactly do we mean by self-help? Self-help refers to a process of self-change guided by the use of materials designed for this purpose. So traditionally, self-help took the form of simple bibliotherapy, where the individual was given a book or a leaflet to take away with them to read and supervised. But more recently, interventions have become increasingly more complex, now employing a range of health technologies, such as the use of CDs, DVDs, CD-ROMs, and of course the internet. So self-help interventions for mental health problems generally have a substantial psychological basis and are used within the healthcare system as part of a stepped care treatment approach, where individuals first presenting with a condition are given the most simple form of treatment, and only those who don't benefit from this simple treatment go on to receive the more complex treatments. So self-help can generally be broken down into two main groups, but of course there are lots that sort of fall between these two groups. So these two groups are pure self-help and guided self-help, and I'm going to discuss both of these approaches in a little bit more detail. So pure self-help involves the use of self-help materials with no guidance from a professional. Presentation can be in a range of media, and randomised controlled trials have reported on the effectiveness of pure self-help for disorders including depression, bulimia nervosa, and panic disorder. To my knowledge, there's been only one randomised controlled trial of a pure self-help intervention for individuals formally diagnosed with sort of clinically relevant PTSD to date. Ellis and colleagues compared pure self-help with up to 12 sessions of traditional face-to-face cognitive behavioural therapy or repeated assessments in 85 road traffic accident survivors. In this study, self-help was found to be no more effective than self-monitoring and significantly inferior to cognitive behavioural therapy. So this doesn't seem too promising, but the intervention was not thought to be optimal in terms of materials used, which were very basic and generally just sort of consisted of psychoeducation rather than any sort of techniques as such. And also the way in which it was delivered. So it was in no way guided, and no follow-up appointments were made to sort of check up on how people were doing and whether they were getting on okay with the materials. So studies have found additional benefit from using guided self-help compared with pure self-help. So guided self-help combines the use of self-help materials with regular, brief contact with a therapist. So this contact is used to identify the individual's issues, to direct them to relevant materials, and to tackle any difficulties they have using the programme. The guiding therapist also aims to motivate use of the materials, so to encourage the person to use them as much as possible. And promising results have been found, especially with bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, and depression. So most of the randomised controlled trials for guided self-help interventions for PTSD have looked at individuals with sub-threshold traumatic stress symptoms, or students who've been through a traumatic experience of some sort, such as a relationship breakup. So not individuals that have PTSD per se. Litz and colleagues, however, did a randomised controlled trials of individuals with PTSD, and they compared therapist-assisted internet self-management CBT with internet-based supportive counselling in 45 US servicemen and women who had either been deployed to Iraq or Afghanistan or had been at the Pentagon at the time of the 9/11 attacks. So the 8-week programme, the therapist-assisted internet self-management, included psychoeducation, advice on sleep hygiene, anger management and relaxation. It also included in vivo exposure to situations that the individuals had been avoiding, and also writing about the traumatic events themselves. So both programmes reduced the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, but the trauma-focused internet self-management CBT was the most effective of the two programmes. This programme, however, was very much focused on combat-related PTSD and issues relevant to sort of military exposure. So it's difficult to know how this would translate to a civilian population. So to summarise the points I've made so far, there's a shortage of suitably qualified therapists able to deliver psychological interventions for PTSD. So we really do need to look at other delivery methods to alleviate this problem. And guided self-help has shown promise for numerous disorders, but in my opinion, it's not been sufficiently explored for post-traumatic stress disorder. So the aim of this project is to develop and pilot test a guided self-help programme for mild to moderate post-traumatic stress disorder. So I briefly want to describe the aims of this research and the methods that we're using to develop a programme. So our main research aims are to determine the critical components of a guided self-help programme, so what exactly should be included in the programme, the clinical outcome in terms of reducing traumatic stress symptoms and also symptoms of anxiety and depression, how acceptable the delivery method is to individuals using the programme and also to clinicians delivering it, and ultimately, we hope to determine whether or not a later phase 2 randomised controlled trial is feasible. So our methodology follows Medical Research Council guidance for the development of a complex intervention. The Medical Research Council is a UK-based organisation funded by taxpayers, which aims to promote medical research with the aim of improving healthcare and also quality of life in the United Kingdom. So this involves 4 steps, which we're following. So the first step is the development of an initial prototype. This initial prototype will then be pre-piloted on a group of up to 10 post-traumatic stress disorder sufferers. The programme will be refined on the basis of their feedback, and the refined programme will be piloted again with a group of another 10 PTSD sufferers. So the first step is to develop an initial prototype, and this work is now complete, so I can describe it in quite some detail. So the first stage was to look at the existing evidence base. So we looked at the evidence for treating post-traumatic stress disorder in general, so what interventions are effective. And we also conducted a systematic review of randomised controlled trials of self-help interventions for the anxiety disorders. So we searched online databases and also hand-searched the reference sections of the papers we thought were relevant. And we found only one study related to post-traumatic stress disorder that met our inclusion criteria, and that was the Ellis study that I discussed earlier. We couldn't include the Litz study because although individuals are said to have post-traumatic stress disorder, it wasn't formally diagnosed as part of the recruitment procedure. So this is one of our inclusion criteria, so we couldn't include that paper. And we also found studies which met our inclusion criteria on obsessive-compulsive disorder, social phobia, generalised anxiety disorder, specific phobia, and also quite a lot on panic disorder. Unfortunately, there was insufficient evidence in the literature to inform how exactly a guided self-help programme for PTSD specifically should look. So this indicated the need for new primary research to determine the components that should be included in a programme, how this should be delivered to individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder, and how it should be guided by a clinician. So in order to answer these questions, we carried out some qualitative research. So qualitative research has traditionally been used in the social sciences, but more recently it has found a place in health research. So quantitative research, which I'm sure most of us are more familiar with, starts off with a hypothesis, which is then tested. Qualitative research, however, begins with a general area of inquiry, and you then generate a hypothesis from the data gathered. So qualitative research relies on a small number of participants who are specifically selected to address the research question, but this creates a large volume of data, and from this data we can derive lots of insightful ideas and hypotheses. So this is ideal, really, for this research, where we didn't really have an idea of how the guided self-help programme would look, and we needed to sort of ask a lot of people what they thought and, you know, about their opinions and their ideas. So data was collected from key stakeholders, and these stakeholders were given a portfolio of information to consider in advance of their participation so that they all sort of had an idea of the evidence base. So this included information on post-traumatic stress disorder and also information on self-help and what we know about self-help in other disorders. So professional stakeholders included researchers, psychiatrists, psychologists and other mental health professionals who had expertise either in post-traumatic stress disorder, self-help, or both. We held two focus groups in Cardiff, and we also held a telephone conference to include individuals who weren't geographically able to attend the focus groups. We asked these individuals to consider the components they thought should be included in a guided self-help programme, how they thought it should be delivered to individuals with post-traumatic stress disorder, and how it should be guided. We also included previously treated individuals, but they weren't included in the focus groups because we thought they'd be more able to express their true opinions if they were interviewed one-to-one rather than, you know, sat around a table with a load of experts. So they were interviewed in semi-structured interviews, and they were asked to reflect on their experiences of receiving psychological therapy for post-traumatic stress disorder. They were asked in particular to look at what they found helpful and what they didn't find so helpful, and what they thought they could have done as part of a guided self-help programme, and what they thought, you know, they couldn't have done. And they were also asked to reflect on the components they thought should be included, how they thought it should be delivered, and how they thought it should be guided. So recordings of focus groups and semi-structured interviews were transcribed verbatim and analysed with the assistance of QSR and Vivo 7 software. So this is software for carrying out a qualitative analysis, and unlike a programme such as SPSS, which carries out a quantitative analysis for you, NVivo just helps you arrange your ideas, so it doesn't actually carry out the analysis for you. So relevant themes were identified using a process of inductive thematic analysis. So inductive thematic analysis is a process of identifying, analysing, interpreting, and also reporting on patterns or themes in the data. This provides a rich description of the entire data set rather than a more in-depth description of a small part of it. So it's a widely used method, especially in healthcare research, but it's said to be poorly branded. So individuals are often using inductive thematic analysis, but they don't state this as a method. They simply say they've looked for themes or looked at what emerges from the data. Or they say that they've carried out a grounded theory analysis without actually subscribing to any of the assumptions of this approach. So we used Braun and Clark's 2006 framework for conducting a thematic analysis. I'm going to present this here as a linear process, but it's in fact a lot more iterative, with a lot of moving backwards and forwards between the different stages, which aren't mutually exclusive. So the six steps begin with a process of familiarisation. And this is achieved through transcription, which it's recommended that the researcher carries out themselves rather than outsourcing to a transcription agency, and also repeated readings of the transcript. So the aim here is to get an idea of what the data set as a whole is saying. And then the process of generating codes can begin. And this involves dividing, marking, and organising the data into meaningful groupings, which are known as codes. So since we decided to do an inductive thematic analysis, coding was a bottom-up process of generating codes from the data rather than using a predetermined set of codes. So each item in the data set, so each transcript of a focus group or an interview, was scrutinised line by line, and we used an open coding method throughout. So this resulted in a comprehensive list of codes, which could then be reviewed, and abstracted into themes, which are a higher order category, so a larger group than the codes. But the aim is to have them specific enough to be non-repetitive, so that a theme sort of represented a certain theme, rather than sort of a lot of different ideas, and also broad enough so that it did kind of accurately represent all the data held within it. So these themes are then reviewed. And this is done by reading and rereading the text segments to ensure the data supports the theme accurately. So this reviewed list of themes can then be defined and named. So the aim is to accurately describe the data. And where the theme can't be accurately defined or named, this suggests that they need to be further reviewed. And so this can involve sort of breaking down a larger theme into two smaller themes, which are more descriptive, merging similar themes to create a larger theme, or abandoning a theme altogether if it doesn't seem that it's sort of accurate. So the resultant themes were discussed with our project steering group, which is another group of experts, and we produced a report on this basis to describe the data set in its entirety and the main findings. And we also try to draw in the literature at this point, so to see whether there are any contradictions between what we found and the evidence base. So the report was used to create an outline of an initial prototype. And this outline was then fed back to all stakeholders who'd contributed to data collection. We invited their comments, criticisms, and suggestions. And the feedback was discussed with the project steering group once more and used to refine the outline for a final time. So the refined outline was used to create an initial prototype, which is now complete. So I can describe this to you. We called the program Tackling Traumatic Stress. It's made up of 12 modules. Some of these modules are mandatory and will be followed by everyone. Other modules are optional and will only be followed where the individual using the programme and their guiding therapist identify that this would be useful. So in this respect, the programme itself will become tailored to the individual. Each module includes three sections: the information section, the quick quiz, and the exercise. So the information section provides some basic psychoeducation and advice for bringing about change in symptoms or other issues. And it concludes in 10 top tips. And these are designed to be the takeaway message, so what the individual remembers from the information section. The quick quiz presents 5 true or false questions. And so we emphasise here that it doesn't matter whether the individual gets these questions right or wrong, that they're only to consolidate learning. We do, however, advise that where the individual gets these questions incorrect, that they refer back to the information and read this again. The exercise is to be completed by the individual and to be discussed with the therapist. So we follow some fictional patient stories throughout the programme. So we've got Michael and we've got Chloe. Michael's a middle-aged father who was involved in a road traffic accident which endangered the life of his son. And Chloe is a shop assistant in her 20s who was attacked on her way home from work. So Michael and Chloe develop different issues as a result of their traumatic experiences, and we follow their stories throughout the different modules. Each individual using the programme will be provided with an activities diary, and they'll be asked to record their use of the self-help materials to later discuss with their therapist, and also to record how they're feeling on a day-to-day basis so they can sort of monitor their own symptoms and see any progress that they're making. We will also be providing information for family and friends. So the aim here is to teach them a little bit about what post-traumatic stress disorder is and what they can do to help and support their loved one. So when it came to delivery, different people seem to favour different presentation methods and sort of commented that different people learnt and enjoyed receiving information in different ways. So it was apparent that choice was important, and on this basis, the programme will be available to follow online or in hard copy. And exactly the same, information, quick quizzes and exercises will be provided in both formats. So our aim is to be interactive so as to be engaging, but also simple so it's not overwhelming to the individual. So the programme will be delivered over 8 weeks. It will begin with an initial 1 hour consultation with a guiding therapist. So they'll receive this face-to-face at the Cardiff and Vale Traumatic Stress Service. They'll see either a psychiatrist or a psychologist. The initial 1 hour consultation will be 1 hour in duration, and they will receive some simple psychoeducation. They'll discuss and identify their issues and be presented with the self-help materials. So after this 1 hour consultation, guidance will be scheduled for once every 2 weeks. And this guidance will be 30 minutes in duration, and it will be used to tackle any difficulties that the individual has and to discuss sort of where to go next, what materials to use next. And individuals can decide whether they want to come into the clinic and receive this guidance face-to-face or whether they'd rather do it over the phone. Individuals will also be given the option of additional guidance between scheduled sessions. And this came out during our data collection stage as being something that was particularly important, especially to the previously treated individuals. So they requested some sort of a safety net so that if they wanted to contact their therapist between sessions, they could do this. So individuals will be given a phone number that they can ring, which will be a clinic secretary, who will give some indication of when the therapist will be able to get back to them, and also an email address that they can use to get in touch with their therapist that way. So in the initial piloting phase, it'll be useful to see how often patients take up use of this service and whether or not guided self-help for post-traumatic stress disorder represents a true time saving compared with traditional delivery methods. So the programme is made up of 7 mandatory modules, which are listed here. And I'll go through these now. So we begin by looking at what exactly post-traumatic stress disorder is. So we present some basic psychoeducation. We look at the sorts of events that can cause post-traumatic stress disorder, what the symptoms are, and how and why post-traumatic stress disorder starts. So our aim here is to answer all the questions which individuals first diagnosed with PTSD tend to have. We emphasise that disorder is a treatable condition and one that can be overcome with some hard work. We also present some tips to help the individual through the programme. Towards the beginning of the programme, we teach some grounding techniques, and we hope that individuals will draw on these throughout the programme. So we begin by looking at what exactly grounding is, because it's believed this would be an alien concept to most people coming into the programme. So we present it as something that keeps the individual in the here and now and connected to the present moment when they feel that their anxiety is spiralling out of control, that they're feeling panicky, or they're experiencing a flashback. So we suggest a variety of techniques using the different senses. So sight, such as creating an inventory of everything that the individual sees around them. Sound, so equally creating an inventory of sounds, listening to loud music or talking aloud. Smell, so smelling something with a strong fragrance, such as a perfume. Touch, and here we advise maybe rubbing an ice cube against the skin or plucking a rubber band that the individual has around their wrist. And also taste, so biting into something with a really strong taste, such as a lemon. So we present lots and lots of different techniques, and we advise that individuals try as many as they like and continue using the ones that they find that are effective for them. So So we advocate practicing these techniques when they're feeling calm, so they can use them easily when they feel that their anxiety is rising. Equally, we present some relaxation techniques towards the start of the program. And again, we hope that individuals will use these throughout the program, especially when they feel that a module is causing them particular anxiety. So again, we look at the importance of learning to relax and why individuals with PTSD often find this difficult. We give instructions on doing a deep breathing exercise and also present a video clip on the website of an expert teaching a client how to do this. We also present a progressive muscular relaxation exercise, and this is available on CD or it's downloadable from the website. And we also acknowledge that individuals don't always benefit from a structured relaxation exercise, and they can take time out to relax in any way that they find is helpful to them. But we also draw a distinction between sort of helpful, healthy ways to relax, such as taking a bath or going for a walk, and sort of less healthy, more destructive ways of relaxing, such as drinking or smoking. So we ask individuals to practice these techniques on a daily basis, to record it in their activities diary, and to sort of let us know how it made them feel. So the Becoming More Active module looks at behavioural activation, so helping individuals resume activities they used to enjoy. So individuals are encouraged to list activities that they'd like to try or want to get back to, and they then set realistic weekly goals, and these are discussed with their therapist. So individuals are asked to carry over any goals they don't achieve 1 week to the next week, and also to reward themselves for any progress. And again, their progress is recorded in the activities diary and discussed with a therapist as and when they receive guidance. We also present some cognitive restructuring, and this is something that seemed to be a bit tricky, really, to include in a guided self-help programme. But we help individuals to identify unhelpful ways of thinking. So we list lots of sort of different and helpful ways of thinking, such as personalisation, where an individual blames themselves for events that are outside of their control, or overgeneralisation, where they believe that because something's happened once, it will always happen. And we also focus on cognitive distortions that are common in PTSD, such as feelings of guilt or shame that arise from the traumatic event itself. And the module concludes in exercises which are aimed at cognitive restructuring. And then the Overcoming Avoidance module looks at graded real-life exposure to situations that the individual has been avoiding. So the individual is encouraged to list all of the things that they've been avoiding since the traumatic event. And these are discussed with their therapist, and they create a hierarchy of these situations, ranging from the one that causes them the least fear up to the one that causes them the most fear. They then tackle these situations one by one, again with realistic goals. They're encouraged to reward themselves for progress, again in a healthy way rather than an unhealthy way, and to record their progress in their activities diary. So the final mandatory module is a module on staying well. So here we give advice on relapse prevention. We encourage individuals to continue using the techniques they learnt during the programme, especially the ones they found helpful. And we look at recognising the potential for relapse, so looking at signs of a relapse and also triggers. And we look at what to do in case of symptoms returning. And here we encourage the individual to initially refer back to their guided self-help programme and use the same techniques they learnt the first time again. And if this doesn't work out for them, to get back in touch with their therapist or with their GP. So those are the mandatory modules. And we also have 5 optional modules. We look at getting a better night's sleep, so providing some advice on sleep hygiene. We look at controlling anger. We present lots of techniques for bringing down levels of anger where the individual is provoked in some way. We look at cutting down drinking to within sensible drinking limits. We also look at getting more physical exercise, which is obviously very helpful to individuals with mental health problems. And we've also included, as an optional module, a module on coming to terms with what happened. And this looks at imaginal exposure, and I'll explain now why this is an optional module. So it was quite controversial when we were collecting data as to whether or not we should include imaginal exposure. So some individuals believe strongly that it should be included and that a programme for PTSD wouldn't be complete or effective without it. Other individuals believed strongly that this wasn't something you could do as part of a guided self-help programme, so it shouldn't be included. So So as a compromise, in the initial piloting phase, we've included it as an optional module. So where the therapist and the individual using the programme agree that the individual could cope with this, they'll carry it out. But we do sort of specify that one of the scheduled guidance sessions should be dedicated to imaginal exposure if the individual is to do this. So we tackle this by writing a trauma narrative. So the individual writes in detail about what happened to them in the first person and the present tense. And we give an example of Chloe, one of our fictional patients, her trauma narrative to give an idea of what's expected. We encourage the individual to read this on a daily basis to habituate to it. We also help them to identify and consider the most distressing points and to consider why this causes them so much distress, and also to discuss these points with their therapist. So I'm going to discuss the website in a little bit more detail now, as I've said, it's exactly the same materials I've just discussed, but presented online. Unfortunately, we didn't have any money in our budget to create a website because we weren't initially sure that we would be having one, and I'm a PhD student, so I don't get much funding. So we created it ourselves using a service offered by Yola at www.yola.com, formerly known as Synthesite. And this is a website which offers the facility to create a website from a limited number of designs, and they also host the website. And this service is offered completely free of charge, and it's really easy to sort of amend it or update it at any point. So for pre-piloting, it's great. We can just sort of change it whenever we like. So exactly the same information is presented on the website as in the hard copy, with the addition of video clips. So we have a psychiatrist presenting the information, and also we hired actors to present the patient's stories. And hopefully I can show you one of these videos now.
About 3 years ago, I was walking down a road bus in Palestine, driving my son back from a Christmas party, and a drunk driver came and abandoned, lost control of his car, and crashed into the passenger side of our car. And my son was injured, taken to hospital. Fortunately, he was okay. He healed up from his injuries. But in the days and days following that, I couldn't really understand and I couldn't accept what had happened. I used to then wake up at night. I was quite anxious and quite stressed. I was awake at night and I was just screaming in my ears. I could hear the sound of screeching tires. I could hear my son screaming. And I was very angry. Very angry that this drunk driver had put my son in danger, put my family in danger. I couldn't really concentrate at work. I was quite tense, quite anxious, and I was sort of startled by things quite a lot. Wasn't really difficult in sleeping, and I used to hear the sound of tired screeching, and hear my son screaming as well. It was quite difficult. It was also quite difficult to be sociable and to be going out and doing activities, things that I'd done before, because I couldn't really. I just didn't feel very relaxed. I didn't feel very relaxed. I was quite anxious and tense all the time.
So that was Michael. And this is the home page of the website. So you can see the modules listed down the left-hand side. So individuals can click on the module that they want to access. This brings them to an index screen, and from here they can access the information, the quick quiz, or the exercise. So the information is presented on a page where they can watch an expert presenting this information to them, and they can watch this in one corner of the screen and read the text at the same time if they'd like, and also access the patient's stories. So the quick quiz is presented on a page, so individuals can answer these questions, true or false, and scroll through to the next page to find out if they were right or wrong with a justification for these answers. And the exercise is also presented online, but unfortunately we don't have the facility for the individual to actually complete these exercises online at the moment, so they're encouraged to do so either in their hard copy or using a blank Word document. So initially, as I've said, we didn't necessarily intend to have a website, but it's something that was mentioned by individuals in our data collection stage. And so it'll be interesting to see whether the website is popular, and if it is, we'll secure funding to have a professional website made. So the initial prototype's all ready to go, and we're in a position to start pre-piloting. So the initial prototype will be pre-piloted with up to 10 post-traumatic stress disorder sufferers, and we'll try to get a vaguely equal split of males and females of a variety of different ages who've been involved in different traumatic events. We've recruited our first 4 patients, and we have 2 males, 2 females, 2 who've been involved in road traffic accidents, 1 was raped, and 1 experienced her husband committing suicide. So these 4 individuals, together with 6 others, will complete the 8-week programme, either online or in hard copy, guided by a therapist. And we'll be assessing patients before and after the programme, and also at a 1-month follow-up. And we'll be looking at symptoms of traumatic stress using the CAPS and the PSS, depression and anxiety using the BDI and the BAI. We'll be looking at disability using the SDS, social supports using the SSQ, and we'll be administering the EQ5D also, which gives a measure of quality of life. And we'll also actually be looking at alcohol using the audit questionnaire, which I haven't listed there. So individuals will then be interviewed after going through the 8-week programme. They'll be asked to reflect on how they found it, what they found helpful, what they found unhelpful. They'll be asked to comment on any improvements they think can be made, any unwanted effects they may have had, and whether or not they found the delivery method to be acceptable. We'll also be asking the guiding therapist whether it was acceptable as a delivery method to them. So these interviews will then be transcribed and analysed, and feedback will be discussed with further focus groups. So we'll then be in a position to pilot the programme again, the refined programme. So it will be piloted on another 10 post-traumatic stress disorder sufferers. We'll be using the same outcome measures as before, and these individuals will again be interviewed and their feedback used to refine the programme for a final time. So the result will be a guided self-help programme which has been pre-piloted, refined and piloted again. We can then come to conclusions regarding the potential effectiveness of the delivery method and the acceptability of it to those using the programme and also to those delivering it. So to summarise and conclude, trauma-focused psychological therapies represent the most effective way of treating PTSD. There is, however, a shortage of suitably qualified therapists able to deliver these interventions. Guided self-help is a potential alternative method which has not been adequately explored. So our aim is to develop and pilot test a guided self-help programme for mild to moderate post-traumatic stress disorder. So an initial prototype has been developed, and this is currently being pre-piloted. Our aim is to produce an optimal guided self-help programme and ultimately to determine whether a phase 2 randomised controlled trial is feasible. So that's all I have to say. Are there any questions or comments? Yes.
Yeah, first of all, thank you for your presentation. I'm especially impressed by the raw method of putting together the program. And what I was wondering, how does the content and the elements, the modules of this program relate to conventional forms of treatment for post-traumatic stress?
Well, it's largely based on CBT, which is sort of evidence-based in treating post-traumatic stress disorder in a face-to-face basis. So it sort of mirrors traditional therapy, but obviously there are certain aspects that can't be sort of presented in the same way. So it's quite similar, really.
Thanks a lot for the presentation. It's really informative. It's very interesting to hear your what you came up with, because it resembles quite a lot how our programs look like. There are some specifics I wonder about, like the first thing you put ground, is that more like mindfulness, really, isn't it? Kind of mindfulness, being aware of sensations, or how do you view it? What's the difference between mindfulness and this thing? Grounding.
I guess there are sort of similarities, but I think mindfulness, that's sort of based on Buddhism, isn't it? And sort of being aware of things around you in the present moment.
Yeah,
so I guess,
yeah,
to an extent, it is similar. Yeah. But I think it is something that's used quite often in CBT-based approaches, that, you know, especially individuals having flashbacks to sort of keep them aware of their surroundings so they're not sort of overwhelmed by these sort of sensations that they're having. And that's the aim, really, and I think especially in PTSD, and if they're doing imaginal exposure, especially if they're going to be sort of having their anxiety sort of spiraling out of control and feeling panicky, it's something that's designed just to sort of bring them back to the present moment and sort of reassure them, really, and keep them in the here and now. So I guess it is sort of quite similar to mindfulness, yes.
Exactly. Yeah. Another thing I wondered about is, I find it a bit strange, really, that you decided to have imaginal exposure as optional, whereas you have exposure as part of the protocol. So I would guess it would be easier to give instructions on imaginal exposure than it is to give the instruction on seeking out real-life situations.
Yeah, I think we're just sort of looking at sort of levels of distress, really, and I think that individuals, sort of, when they're doing graded real-life exposure, this is something sort of a lot more manageable to them. They do it in sort of little steps, and this will obviously be discussed with their therapist. They'll start with the situation that causes them the least fear and sort of build it up gradually. And when we spoke to patients, they thought this could be something that they could do on their own, but imaginal exposure, actually going through the finer details of, you know, horrible traumatic experiences, that this is something that would cause them a lot of distress. And we were also a little bit concerned about the issue of, you know, possible sort of re-traumatisation if people are sort of going back into their experiences unsupervised, whether this could actually do them more harm than good. So we've included it as an optional module, sort of as a caution, and we'll see how it goes during the piloting phase. And I personally do think that a programme would be a lot more effective if we include it. But it's just that issue of sort of safety, really, to the patient and the sort of potential dangers.
Trauma narrative, and that's something that you as a patient, you can decide how much you would like to write, in what detail you would like.
Yeah,
to
I think it's only really effective if you go into a lot of detail and sort of actually really take yourself back to the time of the event. So, yeah, like I was saying, in the piloting phase, it is an optional module. And it'll be interesting to see how many users of the programme feel comfortable doing this and happy doing it. And it'll be really, really interesting to sort of hear their feedback about how that was and whether they sort of found that acceptable, really.
Just to move there, what you're saying is that, what we find in Quebec is that some people, they do the imaginal exposure at the end of treatment. And once you do the behavioral exposure method, sometimes you don't even need to do imaginal exposure because it's more distressing to the patient.
Mm.
And I agree with you that putting it as an optional module, maybe the client will still need to work on his trauma, but maybe not. Maybe with just behavioral exposure, it will be fine for him, or for her. So,
I mean, the inclusion of imaginal exposure was completely the most controversial sort of aspect of it, and you know, some people believed adamantly that it should be included and some people believed adamantly that we really, really shouldn't go there. So it's just a compromise, really, at this stage to include it as an optional module, and it'll be really interesting to see how that goes during piloting.
And how do you decide to advise on using the optional module for imaginal exposure? Because you said in your presentation that you will see within the therapist sessions whether you would advise to do the optional model of imaginal exposure or you would advise against it. So how do you decide then?
Well, it'll be discussed with the therapist, and obviously they're very, very experienced individuals, you know, experienced trauma therapists. And so it would be sort of be down to their judgment in part whether they think the individual can cope with it. And also, obviously, if the individual's like, no, I completely couldn't go there. And I guess that, in a way, would indicate that the programme perhaps hasn't been successful for them and that they're maybe candidates for face-to-face therapy anyway. So
there's a combination of what the therapist thinks, if they can cope with it, and if the patient thinks he's up to it.
Yeah. And also whether or not it's necessary, I guess. I mean, maybe for some individuals, they're quite happy talking about it openly, and by the end of the program, because this will be sort of towards the end of the program as well, you know, it's just a case of waiting and seeing, I guess, for the initial sort of piloting phase and seeing what comes about.
Okay.
Yes?
You're not the only one that's kind of debated about the exposures in general online. That's something we've definitely struggled with a lot about presenting material and worrying about the safety of it, whether an individual will rush out and try an exposure in an unsafe situation. Similarly with the imaginal exposures, this is something our review boards as well as collaborators have kind of tossed around and worried about some of those safety issues that even when they're guided.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of those concerns. And I was wondering what kind of plans you had in place for presenting the material, but in such a way that you're making sure that these individuals aren't charging ahead and overachieving before they're getting the guidance.
Well, we've sort of specified that if an individual is going to do imaginal exposure, that one of their scheduled sessions will be dedicated to this, so they can receive some instructions from their therapists, either over the phone or face-to-face. And then we provide instructions, quite detailed instructions in the programme itself as to how to do this. And then also we provide the additional safety net of being able to contact the therapist as and when the individual needs to. So, and we also emphasise this in the imaginal exposure section that, you know, if they're having any adverse reactions, that they should get in touch with their therapist or simply sort of stop reading their narrative and, you know, do a relaxation exercise. So we have... Sorry?
Same for in vivo?
Yes, same for in vivo.
We have used exposure techniques hundreds of patients in our trials and in clinic, and it works perfectly well. Actually, I think it could even be a higher risk of re-traumatization with the therapist that pushes you.
Mm.
Whereas if you get this instruction, you understand why you should do it. I think that's part of your protocol as well. You should never expose someone unless they understand the reason, what you can expect, when to stop, etc. So all these safety net precautions are very possible to write down and present in text. So I think for patients, sometimes at least, in addition, it's something we encourage patients to do. Now we've done this in the session, now you go home and practice, and there's no safety precautions regarding... Well, and they have to wait till the next week, and no phone number sometimes even.
Yeah, so I agree.
Whereas in an online treatment, you can just email immediately and say, I really couldn't do this, it was too difficult.
It's one of those weird topics where, for some reason, people get sweaty about it.
Yeah, it's clinician's mistake, clinician's errors.
Yeah.
They think exposure is a terrible thing. Yes, it is a terrible thing very often in the therapist's
office. But not the in vivo. That's the interesting part is that we've had the same experience with reviewers who have been very agitated about the imaginal exposure and the trauma narrative, but less agitated about the in vivo exposure, which with my patients in clinical work, it's often the reverse. They're more worried about going out to the field than being in office. So I really think it may be an artifact of individuals not fully understanding the internet as a mechanism.
Or text, the difference, what you remember from a text presentation, and we know that a lot of our patients remember very little of what we said. I think I'm a very clever therapist, and I can explain how your anxiety will decrease. And I'm sure if you would ask the patient, what did the therapist say? It was nice. So there's no way to repeat the message, and especially some of these patients are very anxious with the therapist. And when they sit down, calm and relaxed, and read, is this how it works? So otherwise we would never get those results. It works in a different way. But I was sort of, what you said, I think I don't know if you meant that, But there, in my experience, there are patients who are more worried by the representation than the real thing. So if you, so when you're exposed to the real thing, the representation of it doesn't make doesn't matter. So if you go out in vivo and you expose yourself, then I don't care to write about it. Whereas there are patients who really don't feel anything when they're exposed to the live thing. It is the memory, it's the representation that makes the difference. So I would guess that you, if you could sort of lead patients to the ones instead of the ones who would be more worried about the structured writing, I think you would have the ones who didn't respond to the live exposure because they are more worried about the representation and the whole thing, that how it actually happened, etc.
Yeah, it would be really interesting to see how patients respond to it.
Then I think another thing has to do with assessment. When you assess patients, you very often, if you do an interview, for instance, you will need to ask them what kind of trauma did you have. So that in itself might influence, be the first exposure, which we sometimes tend to forget, that our assessment is actually exposing them to a lot of information. Oh, I have these symptoms. Oh, I don't have that symptom. All these hundreds of questions that you also will ask.
I agree with that. But we have also sort of stated that the guiding therapist in the initial session, that they sort of don't delve into the traumatic event too much if the individual isn't happy with that. So that's, you know, we've tried to sort of avoid doing that too much, to avoid sort of like a sort of debriefing, sort of one-off sort of exposure and then them going off. So, but obviously, if, you know, like you say, in order to assess a patient in the first place, you do have to ask a lot of questions, and they are to some degree exposed to it. So I agree.
One of the things I was thinking about in the description of the grounding techniques, I wonder if there will be any overlap or kind of reverse relationship between that and the avoidance section. Have you given any thought to that?
I have given that a lot of thought as well.
Yeah.
But I think especially with like a self-help approach, people sort of, the stakeholders, they sort of all said that you need to have some sort of techniques in place that so individuals kind of feel empowered to reduce their own anxiety levels if, you know, they're doing these things on their own. So we've included that for that reason, really. But again, that would be very interesting to sort of ask patients whether those things actually increase their avoidance, whether using those techniques was a form of avoidance for them. So, yeah.
In my experience, it's good to have exercises or homework assignments early on that most of them are able to complete, like describing the event or whatever it is, if it's in a simple way, or what are the situations you avoid. You should be able to do that. Whereas you get more difficult to sign homework assignments later on.
Because
otherwise you frighten people away if it becomes too difficult too early. Another thing I like, we've been using that for years now, is to have quiz between modules. So there was one of my students who had this idea that we shouldn't give them access to the next module unless they responded correctly to the quiz. They can repeat the quiz, but they need to. And I thought that would be ridiculous. They will think we're stupid to do a thing like that, but it worked perfectly well. Mm. And people are very happy with that. Responding to the quiz, and if you fail, you do it again until you get the correct answer, and then providing the explanation why this is the correct answer.
Yeah.
So that would be something for the website.
Do you plan to intervention accessible to other psychologists or just for your
this current project is just a development phase, sort of developing and piloting a program, and if it seems to sort of show potential and if it seems sort of acceptable to people, then we'll be sort of applying for funding to hopefully do a randomized control trial. But at this stage it's sort of wait and see how it goes sort of thing. So
one last question.
So you were saying that the website that you're developing right now, the free one that you have on, is your clients or your participants going to have a login to just access that site because it's on the net? So it can be accessed by...
It can be, but it doesn't come up on Google or anything like that. It's an HH... Well, I don't know the technical... It's not www.guide.address. So individuals can't... I don't think individuals sort of come across it, but the program that we use to create the program, you could only, the only sort of login thing you could have involved logging into every page individually, and I thought that would just drive people mad. So, so yeah, it's, you don't need to log in at all. So.
But you could do that once
you establish
the final content.
And yeah.
Go to test it in RCT.
Mm-hmm, definitely, yes, we do that then.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.